Accession number 28698, Real 2.
Major Lawton, Real 2. You told your mother that, fait accompli, really, you'd arrived and you were going to join that. How did she take it?
Well, she didn't take it very well, because again, I was the only one working and fetching away, Jane, and Sheila and Paul were still at school. I said I was going, she didn't stop me. Went back to the recruiting office and said, fine, I'm joining up as long as I can go on the Durham Light Infantry. They sent me to Darlington to do my swearing in of allegiance, give me my bus fare back home from Darlington to Durham, and 2 days later I was on a train to Shrewsbury for the Light Infantry Brigade Depot.
And was it the fact that you were tired of farming, or that your brother was in the army, did this lead you towards the army? Or was it just a spur of the moment thing, which is what it sounds?
It was a spur of the moment thing, because even at school I talked about farming. I went to Hoffel College and did farming. The army had never entered my head, and it was just one day passing the recruiting office and I said, I'm going to join up. It had nothing to do with my brother being in the army already. I just, for the moment, that particular day, decided I was going to join the army, and that's what I did.
Did they still give you the King's Shilling when you joined?
No, it didn't. You got your little prayer book, and that was it. That's all I can remember getting anyway, the prayer book. And even at the last minute before I was swearing my allegiance, they were still trying to get me to either go in a corps or even join the Royal Green Jackets, having said to me, well, you know the DLI will be disbanded in less than a year's time. I still wanted to join the DLI. So I stuck to my guns and went.
And so within 2 days, did you say you were on your way?
Yes, they sent me my travel warrants and a train journey down to Shrewsbury, passing through Darlington, Stockport, Stalybridge, Crewe and Shrewsbury. Having never left Durham in my life before, I was scared safe that I was on the wrong train, getting off the wrong stop. But later that day, I arrived in Shrewsbury and attended the Light Infantry Brigade depot.
Right, you arrived at the gates. What was the reception that you got?
I remember a big fat corporal, in a way, coming out saying, who's the Geordie among you lot? And, of course, being from Durham, I didn't class myself as a Geordie. There was a guy from Middlesbrough and another guy from Bristol, got off the same bus as I did. So I said, where are you from? And I said, I'm from Durham. He said, where in Durham? And I said, Brandon. So the next thing I do, I was picking myself off the floor, and he says, well, I'm Corporal Foster, and I'm from Brum Park, which was another pit village. So having clouted me around the lug and put me on my arse, then I got up, and that corporal actually looked after me throughout my training. Absolutely brilliant.
So what happened to you next? He's got hold of you, in effect. Where did you go? What happened on that same day, that same time?
Yep, we were taken then to our blocks and said, you'll be in Durham Block as a recruit in Anzio Platoon, and assured us our bed spaces and everything else. I must say at this time, I had long hair halfway down my back. It was blonde and wavy, and I was wearing a teddy boy suit. I had a £5 note in my pocket and a toothbrush, my worldly possessions. He introduced us to other people who'd arrived earlier in the day, from Yorkshire, from Somerset, from Cornwall. We were given a quick briefing, told where we'd go for a meal, and a platoon sergeant would come in later that evening to talk to us. So that was the introduction to the army.
And Shrewsbury was the major light infantry training depot?
It was called the LIBD, Light Infantry Brigade Depot, and it was an amalgamation of the Somerset and Cornwall Light Infantry, the King's Shropshire Light Infantry, the King's Yorkshire Light Infantry, and the Durham Light Infantry, who'd all come under one banner to train, although the county battalions were still in existence.
Can you describe the camp itself?
Yes. To me, it was a big, wide-open space with a big square in the middle, surrounded by oak trees, some old buildings and some new. And each of the blocks had Durham, Yorkshire, Somerset, Cornwall, and then this beautiful, magnificent, that I found out later, was the officer's mess. And behind that, you had a sands mess, and then cricket pitches, football pitches, rugby pitches. It was a beautiful place to be.
And the building block, were they similar? You've mentioned the various titles, Durham Block, what have you. Were they similar buildings?
Yes, they were. They were all exactly the same and formed the quadrangle around the square. And then in the bottom corner, there was another place that was still the wooden huts, and we called them the white huts because they were painted white. and they some people still lived in them, and the other huts were used for training classrooms, etc. And then there was another more modern building at the end, which we found later was for the junior soldiers. I was no affair with junior soldiers at the time, but they were the guys who joined up at 15 and 16 year old and did all their early teenage years training to be soldiers and eventually leaders.
Can you describe a building block?
Yep, they were big and the rectangle, two stories high, with big high windows. The rooms were 20-man rooms with highly polished wooden floors, which we learned to love and hate at the same time because they all had to be highly built at the same time. Very sparsely fitted. You had a metal 6-foot locker, a carpet that was about 3 foot by 2 foot, and your metal bed. And that was it. Each man had one of them, and it was locker, bed, locker, bed, locker, bed, all the way around the walls. And all the rooms were identical.
Was there a table in the middle?
No, we had no tables. There was no obstructions in the middle, or just the highly polished wooden floor.
And what about heating? How were they warmed?
The rooms were heated with pipes going round. And the other thing of note in the room was like a radio box above the door. And that was, you got music through it, pumped through it throughout the day. And it was also the tannoy system for announcing things like, get outside now.
And where were the ablutions in relation to the sleeping quarters?
There was a central stairway that went straight up the middle of the floor, and there'd be two rooms on the bottom floor, two rooms on the top floor. The ablutions, again, were on the bottom floor and directly above it on the top floor. Communal baths, communal showers, communal sinks.
And you had to keep these clean yourselves? This was...
Everything was highly polished. We were shown how to clean a toilet, how to clean a sink, how to clean the showers, how to make sure there was no mildew appearing on the walls or anything else. They're quite old buildings, but we had to keep them 100% clean at all times.
And how did you keep the floors clean of the rooms?
We used to have the great big army bumpers that in the day we thought were quite heavy. And then one man in the room would have to sacrifice the blanket because they all had to be paid for if you destroyed them. And then you'd put the bumper on top of the blanket, having put the yellow waxy polish down and spread it all over the floor. Then you'd get somebody to stand on the bumper to add extra weight, and a couple of lads would bump it up and down and up and down till that floor was shining. And if it was an inspection day, everybody would take a blanket off the bed, put it on the floor, and you'd rather walk on the blankets than walk on your floor.
And then you said there were 20 men to a room.
Yep.
Were these the metal beds that pushed in when they weren't being used? No, I'm thinking of the biscuit. You remember the biscuit arrangements of the older?
No, there were single beds. At least there were single beds. Later in life, I've lived in bunk beds. But no, there were single beds. And like I say, it was locker bed, locker bed, locker bed. 10 up one side, 10 down the other side.
Comfortable?
Yeah. Well, it was a bed.
And what had the issue with as regards blankets and sheets and so on?
Well, you've got your four blankets, your two sheets and your two pillowcases and your two pillows. And at this stage, we hadn't been issued any army clothing.
Yes, we'll come to that shortly. I was just wanting to deal basically with the rooms and the structure of the rooms and so on.
No,
so get a picture of them.
Yeah, we're given a big tub of yellow wax polish, and we were told that had to last at least a month, but your floor had to be cleaned to the highest standard. You'd have some vim and you'd have some wire wool for the ablutions and some brasso for everything that was brass. And again, told that would last. And once you ran out, if it wasn't the end of the month, then you would have to pay for it. So we all tried to use it sparingly, knowing that the standard had to be of the highest.
And did you have an area of your own bed space to look after and keep clean, tidy, as against all of you joining in to keep the whole room?
Yeah, you had your 6 foot by, my 6 foot by 6 foot, I suppose. That, your locker and your bed fitted in exactly in your little bedside locker, and that was it. That had to be yours. And of course we soon found out, because in them days you had to blanco belts on that the underside of your little mat was always used for blanco on your belt, so nobody ever saw the muck underneath.
Was there an NCO sleeping in the quarters with you?
No. Well, yeah, I'm saying no, not in the rooms, but they had an NCO's bunk at the end of each room, between the room and the ablutions. So he was your block NCO, yes.
Outside you have your square, which is sacrosanct in there.
Oh, yes.
And quite big.
Yes. Yes, because in them days, of course, there was hundreds of recruits, and you could be doing drill rehearsals at one end of the square and a full-blown parade on the other square. Yes, it was a place of wonder for a young man coming straight off a farm to see this.
And were you allowed to walk over it just in the normal course of events?
Nowhere. There was nowhere could you walk on that square, because some voice from some window somewhere would scream, "Get off that square." No, squares in them days were for drill and drill only, not for walking across.
Can we come now to the, where was the eating areas for, in relation to your blocks?
The cookhouse is only 100, 150 metres away from our particular block, but of course adjacent to some of the other blocks. And again, big typical building, long tables where platoons of people would sit together to eat. They were clean, they were tidy, and the food was substantial. Again, very surprising for me, all of a sudden 3 meals a day. Never had that in my life before.
A guard room at the entrance gates?
Guard room at the entrance gates, the big wrought iron gates of St. John Bower Barracks. And the first building you came to was the guard room on the right, with its highly polished bells and shells and everything else that goes with the outside of a guard room.
The instructors themselves, were they old men, older men?
They were certainly older than us. I mean, they were in the 20s and the 30s. Several had medals because of conscript days and Borneo and Korea and other battles they'd been in at the time. They were excellent. They were highly disciplined. And to us at the time, very, very smart.
How did you take to the language?
There was no language. If you're talking about bad language, swearing that, I can't remember anybody ever swearing. I mean, we certainly didn't swear. And we weren't sworn at, certainly not by our instructors. They were harsh in what they said and the way they said it, but to this day I can never remember any foul language at all.
Not like the television thing that's on a bit there.
Oh, certainly not like Bad Lads Army. I mean, even I thought that was disgraceful, because I've never, ever heard soldiers in 38 years of service swearing like that. Never.
Can we now come to your uniform? At what point in your new career did you get your uniform? Was it the same day as you arrived?
No, most people got it within 2 days, because the following day after we arrived, we were taken around camp and shown, this is your cookhouse, this is the barber shop, this is the education centres, this is your training classrooms, this is your church, this is your NAFI, this is your WRVS. The second day after that, everyone in my intake were issued uniform. In fact, yes, I was issued mine at the same time. It was the haircut they didn't give me at the same time, because my hair was so long. It was some bit of what of a novelty to them that they let me keep my hair for about 3 days. But yes, on the second day and the third day, we got our uniforms.
How were you issued?
We're all lined up in a straight line outside the clothing store. And inside the clothing store, there was a long counter, about 20 or 30 feet long. And on the counter, there was piles of shirts, trousers, socks, housewives, button sticks, all that kind of thing, and then on top a steel helmet clamped on top of that, and there'd be about 10 piles in one go, and the first 10 would be called in by number, rank and name, because it was another way of making us remember our numbers. And then they would say, right, 5 foot 6, yeah, that'll fit, and if it's not, you'll grow into it, and if it's too tight, you're too fat, you'll have to slim down. So you were issued with your pile as it was, near as damn it to sizes. 10 would march out, 10 would march in, and by that time another 10 sets of clothing would be piled up. And of course, one of the last things was put on was your pot mug, and you were told, break that and you'll pay for it. And of course, that was balanced precariously on top of your helmet. So you grab that, you try and grab your pile, and it was out. And then when all 30 or 40 men had their clothing, you'd be marched outside. Although we hadn't been taught any drill then, and then it'd be a case of you would shuffle off to your back to your rooms and you would lay it out. Once you'd laid it out, you were told to try some of it on. And of course, in my case, the trousers were all too big and the shirts were all too big, and you'd say, "Corporal," and they would say, "No, you'll grow into it," and then say, "No, that's absolutely ridiculous." Line up back outside, and so everybody who had things that were outstanding, too big or too small, we'll be marched back across once everybody had everything and say, right, change that for that size, change that for that size. The only thing they were particular about that did fit was the size of your boots. And obviously that came a little bit obvious later, although the boots them days were hard leather. So we had our clothes.
Were they studded boots?
No, we weren't. No, they were DMS rubber boots, ankle boots, and gaiters. We still had gaiters in them days. And then you'd lay it on the floor, and you turned all over, and you see where your white patches were. And then in comes Corporal Foster again, the guy from Brum Park, and a pot of Indian ink and the old writing pen that we used to have at school. And he did the demonstration of how to put your last four numbers and your name on every item of kit you had. And another corporal come in and he had metal stamps so you could stamp your last four numbers on your boots so nobody else could steal your boots. And then you would mark everything from your towels to your shirts to your trousers, to your battle dress tunics and everything else. And the same corporal actually demonstrated on all my kit. So for counting me the first day I arrived, he actually marked all my kit up with this Indian ink. So the next couple of hours were spent everybody marking kit and stamping boots, etc., etc.
What was the quality of the uniform? Had it improved from the war, the Second World War?
We were still issued with a battle dress and a greatcoat.
It was the same material.
But the material was heavy-duty denim material in different shades of green, obviously bulk order. And you had denim jackets. And the shirts were all KF shirts, green and hairy and brown and hairy. And your socks were all either brown and woolly or grey and woolly, depends on what you got. And your black pumps or daps or whatever you want to call them these days. It was rough and it was ready. And the other thing they taught us on the same day, anything that had a loose thread, you had to take your razor blade out, your razor, and cut all the loose threads off. So there was nothing, no threads anywhere, any part of your uniform. You had to check all your buttons were securely fixed on. If not, out came your housewife and they showed you how to sew your buttons on so they wouldn't come off. And all your kit was laid out. The other thing you had to stamp with the metal stamps as it came round to your turn was your button stick, because that button stick got some hammer through training, I'll tell you. And of course you had to try and write your name on your mug. And the last thing that they give you was a lock and two keys for your metal locker. And that was your clothing supply. So the afternoon was taken up receiving your kit, marking your kit, and then securing your kit in your locker. For a corporal to come back that night to show you to take it all back out again to show you how to press it.
Did you have your own irons issued, or was there one iron per room, or what was the?
There was about four irons per room. So, I mean, I was all right because I'd been self-sufficient at home and I knew how to use an iron. Of course, you had people from different parts of the country who had things done for them. So it was a case of smash and grab, and the first people could use an iron to get on first, because you were limited in time of what time you could have the iron to get your bits and pieces done. Then the iron and the iron board was passed around the room till everybody had done it. But while they were pressing kit, you were polishing shoes. While they were doing something like that, you were cleaning the ablutions. So it was concurrent activity. Somebody was doing something all the time.
Were you picking up the little secrets of keeping your creases particularly sharp, or the old army soldiers' method of?
We got that off some of the junior soldiers who had passed out from juniors and are now in regular training, and some who'd been ACF. And they'd come in.
Army Cadet Force.
And they'd known all the little tricks of the trade. And a young lad called Baff Brown from Yorkshire, broad Yorkshire, he'd come across from me, more or less, in a way, befriended me day one, and said, look, this is how we do it in the cadets. And he showed us how to put the creases in and put the soap inside the creases so you could stick them together. And somebody else said, oh, this is how you shave your battle dress and your greatcoat. So, yes, a lot of time was spent in our own time by people who knew from various organisations they'd been in of how to make things a little bit better. And that was over and above what the corporals had taught us. So, yes, comradeship started right from day one.
And shaving your greatcoat, how was that done? A bit dangerous, wouldn't it?
Well,
any danger for the coat and for yourself?
Well, remember the day, it was the old 7 o'clock razor blades, the old blade in, screw them up. And it was a case of just taking some of the rough hair down. So by the time you pressed it and soaped it and shaved it, they looked a bit more shiny and a lot more smarter and pressed.
And you were allowed to do this? That was acceptable?
It was expected. It was expected, because the grey coats and everything and your battle dress was really rough, coarse material. And you couldn't just iron it, you really had to press it and shave it and press it and shave it till it took shape.
Wasn't there any accidents? Did that take off a bit too much?
No, it was just like shaving hair off. It was taking the lumps and bumps out of the coarse material.
And keeping your boots clean, was it still spit and polish?
Yes, it was, but first of all, we were just shown how to polish and how to get into the welts of your boots and how to get over the thread. And I always remember the saying, you can't polish leather, you can only polish polish. So get your polish into the leather. And I remember that from day one, and how to care for your boots. And of course, I was all right coming off a farm. I'd always worn boots and wellies. Other people had only worn shoes and stuff like that, and they find breaking boots in terrible. I didn't have that problem. People who used to, the old soldiers would wee inside them and they'd all kinds of things to make the leather soft. Other people would cut the tops of the boots so that would stick into their ankles. There was all kinds of tricks and trades came out. I had no problem. I wore them as I got them. Grateful for a good pair of boots.
A cap and badge, what were you issued with?
We're actually issued with the light infantry badge. Everybody, irrespective if you were going to the KYLI, KSLI, Somerset Commons or the Durham's, you all got the light infantry badge, and you all got the green beret, and you also got the number one flat hat with a peak. Everybody got that.
Had the brass work on the uniforms changed?
No, you still had the brass, and you still had the 57 pattern belt with the two brass buckles on the back. You still had the gaiters with the two little buckles for your straps. And everything was blanco'd in them days, and you were shown how to put a layer of polish on, then the blanco over the top, so you got a darker green for your belt. And you were shown how to use your button stick to put the brasso on and take your brasso off, and how to get the brasso around the eyelets without putting it all over your web belt. And there's a few thickiers learning that course, because every eye hole and every bit of brass was inspected every day. And if you had blanco on your brass or brass on your blanco, you got the belt round the ear till you got it right. You soon learned the lesson. And then if you put too much blanco on, you're also taught how to use toilet paper and a hot iron to melt it back off till you got it the exact way that the army wanted it. Another quick lesson.
So you must have spent a lot of time keeping yourselves clean in the army style, you know.
A lot of it was done in your own time, because training was training. It was in your sports kit, do your sports, back out, change out of that into your working dress, do your clean fatigue, as it was called in them days. And you'd do your denims and your shirts, and you'd do what you had to do in that, then it was back out, and then if you had to get into a different type of uniform, back up and back out. So on a night time when you were so tired and you thought, well, let's get some hours sleep, of course you knew you had to clean every bit of uniform up that you'd been wearing all day, so it was ready to start the next day. Remembering to clean your boots, get the polish into them welts, etc., etc. And it never changed. And it was good for us.
Had you been issued with a what might be called a best dress uniform, and then a working uniform, and then the usual denims?
Everything was denims. We didn't get the best dress. You don't get that till after about 6 weeks anyway, because you have a 6 weeks passing out parade to make sure that you've adapted, you're going to go on further, and then you'll get your second issue of clothing.
Did the issue with equipment?
You got your weapon, and it was your old 57 pattern weapon, with all the pouches and ponchos, and of course you didn't have a poncho in them days, it was a cape, and it was called a cape carrier. And of course you quickly learned that after a couple of weeks, because that was also your shelter top, and it took two men to put the cape together with the two big buttons on each side, and of course there was nothing to go on the floor then. So you had a shelter over the top, nothing on the floor, and sleeping bags weren't sleeping bags as we know today. In fact, most of the time it was your cape and a little green blanket, and then you're sleeping directly onto the floor as well.
So those you take from the old army capes of the Second World War,
the gas capes.
The gas capes.
Yeah. Well, that ended up being your shelter top. Yeah.
But for 6 weeks then, we've got your uniform and your equipment and your rooms. Meal times, what time did you break for meals, or what time did you have your meals?
Reveille was always up at 6 in the morning, breakfast was always 7. And then at 10 o'clock you'd have what we fondly found out later called your naffy break. And you'd have your half hour naffy break, in the naffy of course, and then at about 12:30 to 1 you'd have your lunch break. And again, this was food like I've never seen before. And then at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you would have like a tiffin time, I think it came to be called, where you'd have a piece of slab cake or rice cake and a cup of tea. And again, you'd go to the cookhouse for that. And your platoon sergeant, your platoon commander would come and talk to you and make sure you're all right. And it was a bit of a welfare chat at the same time. And then evening meal at about 5 o'clock at night was absolutely marvellous, because there'd be three different meats on and different foods, and we were looked after well.
So if we come to breakfast, were you marched to breakfast, or do we march to the canteen on all occasions?
At first we used to march for breakfast till we learned, because it was another way of learning drill at the same time. And of course you had your pot in your hand and your knife, fork and spoon, and your march there. And I think we broke more pots marching to breakfast, clashing into each other. And of course then you had nothing to drink of, and then you'd have to go back to the accommodation, the clothing store, and you'd have to buy a new pot.
How much were they?
They're about 5 shilling, I think.
So your master, what food would they give you for breakfast?
It was your normal cereal, and then your scrambled eggs and your bacon, salty bacon. I always meant the salty bacon. And of course everybody used to talk about the tea tasted funny because it was full of bromide. And I don't know if it was or wasn't, but we were always told the tea was full of bromide for every meal.
And why bromide?
Well, for the obvious reason, there was no women about, and to water down your feelings, I suppose. Yeah.
And you say, was it cafeteria system, or were you served?
No, it was cafeteria system. It was line up and go along and get your meal, and get your knuckles wrapped if you took two sausages instead of one, or if you took bacon and sausage and you still got wrapped for it. But no, it was good. Wholesome food.
And plenty is sufficient.
Oh, yes. Yeah, plenty of food.
And lunchtime, the midday break, what were you given then?
Well, it was your normal lighter snacks. I mean, your main meals was always at 5 o'clock at night, but you would have your fish and chips or your corned beef, and pickles and stuff like that. It was a fairly substantial meal, and of course, unless you were outside in the field, and that would be always a good old cookhouse stew followed by rice pudding. And of course, with the rice pudding came your jam, and you always put your jam in your rice pudding anyway.